I'll start talking. Maybe that'll bring people in. There's sort of two themes, I guess, now. Graham Wright is going to speak first, and his passion is cardiac therapeutics, so that's what I'm sure he's going to be talking about. And then after that, we're going to talk about compressed sensing. So I see people are now starting to come in, so maybe Graham, you could... Graham's at U of T, a professor, and also at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center. Did I change the order of speakers? I don't think so. Okay, so Graham, I'm sure you probably know already, but if not, he's a wonderful guy, and he knows a lot about MRI and the cardiac therapeutics. So having said that, Graham, can you get going?
Level one. Testing.
Okay. Yeah, sure. We'll go with the hopefully people can find their seats. So this talk, I'm going to basically be looking at the role of MRI in the management of ventricular arrhythmias as per the title. It follows very well and complements very well the previous talk. Essentially, I'm going to drill down on one of the areas that Dr. Rudy described in the applications for the electrical imaging. Particularly reentrant circuits with ventricular arrhythmias. And I'm going to focus more on the role of the structural information and how that could inform the electrical studies and perhaps be very complementary to the type of information that Dr. Rudy is acquiring with the vests of surface electrodes. And so specifically, what I want to look at is how we can alter patient management for better outcomes using imaging, particularly MRI. I'll just briefly touch on the prevalence and nature of ventricular arrhythmias. Dr. Rudy mentioned that a little bit, and I'll drill down a little bit into that area. The current treatment approaches and how they could potentially be informed by imaging, particularly identification of the best patients to treat with the various approaches, how to actually directly guide some of the interventions, and how can you assess the outcomes of some of these various therapies. As was noted before, cardiac arrhythmias, particularly ventricular arrhythmias, lead to an annual incidence of sudden cardiac death on the order of 300,000 people in the U.S., and to translate that to Canada, about 20,000 people. Turns out that in most of these patients that die of sudden cardiac death, they had a previous heart attack. They have SCAR, chronic myocardial infarcts, in their hearts, and the majority of these patients will have had ventricular tachycardia, this kind of racing heart, which then degenerates into ventricular fibrillation. So there is a structural basis to many of these deaths. And specifically, this is really a reiteration, this is a heart where we've sort of artificially created what we'll call a reentry circuit in the presence of SCAR. Under usual excitation from the sinoatrial node through the Purkinje fibers, you get this electrical propagation in the heart, which drives the mechanical contraction, and you get this nice, smooth contraction. If you've got some scar tissue in the heart, you may end up with a situation where that electrical propagation ends up looping around the scar tissue and re-exciting the ventricle very rapidly. So whereas you may have, under normal circumstances, a heart rate of 60 to 70 beats per minute, in this sort of case, you're re-exciting the heart very quickly, and you may end up with heart rates above 100 beats per minute, and then these can degenerate with these little spirals and the like into ventricular fibrillation, where the heart's not contracting at all in a consistent manner. Different parts are trying to contract at different times, and therefore it doesn't really functionally push out the blood, and you end up with a situation where the blood isn't getting to the head and the like, and you lead to sudden cardiac death. So how are these patients managed if you identify them in the first place? Some patients who may have had events, you will try and treat with antiarrhythmic drugs. You'll try and manage the heart rate. You'll manage the way that the heart depolarizes, repolarizes. But in fact, in cases with patients with structural heart disease, as was noted, some of these antiarrhythmic drugs can actually become proarrhythmic. So that is a particular concern. So the best solution for these patients right now, quote unquote, is implantable cardioverter defibrillators. Essentially, what you're trying to do is recognize a condition which could become life-threatening very quickly, where the heart starts racing, and shock them out of it or pace them out of it. But it's not a cure. It's a Band-Aid. And these patients will still suffer from events. They just don't die of the events necessarily if these ICDs work properly. The curative strategy would be to get rid of these reentry circuits with ablation, as was noted. This is primarily done right now in the atrium because basically in the ventricle, if you get it wrong, the patient dies. So the more likelihood is right now they'll get an ICD, and if they get a lot of firings of their ICD, they'll try and improve their quality of life by doing an ablation. But if we could confidently identify the reentry isthmuses, the reentry circuits, perhaps we can avoid some of these ICDs. So particularly, this issue of the management of ventricular arrhythmias with ICDs is becoming a major challenge. Initially, patients who had already had some kind of a rapid heart rate ventricular tachycardia event were the ones who were the primary candidates for ICDs. More recently, there's been trials that have suggested that if your heart isn't pumping very well, if the ejection fraction, the amount of blood that goes out of the heart with each heart cycle, is less than 30%, even if you've never had one of these fast pacing events, these ventricular tachycardias, you would benefit from an ICD. And more recently, even those who have even less of a challenge in pumping the blood out of their heart, let's say they get 35% rather than 30% of the blood out of their heart every heartbeat, they also may benefit from these ICDs. So that's all well and good. And based on various analyses, it suggests that it makes sense to put these ICDs in the patient. But that means we're putting ICDs in a lot more patients. Effectively, early on, before 2004, they were primarily being put in for, again, primary prevention, secondary prevention, i.e. those patients who had already had an event. So 60% were secondary, 40% primary. Now more and more, they're becoming primary prevention as we're identifying these patients who could potentially have these events. Unfortunately, this treatment is then based on that criteria, and for instance, in the US, there's about 500,000 people who could potentially benefit from this therapy. This therapy is not cheap, therefore it has a fairly substantial cost to the healthcare system. It would cost about $15 billion to manage these 500,000 patients. So the issue is that this would be great if every time you put in a device, it saved a life. But it turns out that, roughly speaking, only about 1 in 10 of these patients that are getting these devices are actually benefiting from these devices. So you're spending a lot of money to help a relatively small fraction of people. If you could better identify who's going to benefit from these ICDs, you would have more efficient use of your healthcare dollar, and which is obviously important all over the world, and particularly is highly motivating to governments in Canada, as they're the payer. So the challenges with ICD therapy is there are more and more people who would potentially benefit, but they are at high cost, and there are relatively few people actually benefit from these devices going in. So maybe we can be more specific if we can identify with more detailed information, perhaps structural information from MRI, who will benefit. So this is the first aspect that I want to look at. So specifically, again, what's the substrate that we're looking at? We're looking at structural heart disease, people who have had a myocardial heart attack, a myocardial scar, so they have regions of non-conduction. And also, you're going to have a region of slow conduction. So as was noted, you may have a region between these scars, for instance, that is some scar, some healthy tissue, so the action potential propagates more slowly, and by the time it reaches the exit, the tissue at the exit has recovered enough to be re-excited, and that will create a reentry circuit where you'll get this driving function for this rapid heart rate. And just more specifically, in some studies of pathology, this is sort of normal heart tissue. This is this region of slow conduction where you have myocytes, the heart muscle, interspersed with maybe fibrosis, which is conduction blocking. So essentially, you get these more random pathways for conduction, which in a bulk sense slows down the action potential. So that's likely the substrate of one of the substrates of these reentries, as was noted before. Well, it turns out we can look at this with MRI. Specifically, with MRI, if we inject a contrast agent, gadolinium DPPA, that gadolinium DPPA generally can only go into the interstitial space, the space between the cells in healthy tissue. But if you've got infarct regions, if you've got fibrosis, the gadolinium will go into the fibrotic regions. If you've got dead or dying cells, it'll get into those cells. So you basically get more accumulation of the contrast agent. With more contrast agent, the signal in MRI recovers faster, and therefore, with various types of MRI sequences, we can make that signal bright. So this is an MRI image of the main pumping chamber of the heart. This is the left ventricle in short axis view. You can see the nice thick muscle wall. We can set up the sequence so that regions that are healthy are dark, and regions that are infarcted are bright. And it turns out that obviously regions that are sort of a mixture of healthy and infarct tissue will end up being gray, a signal intensity in between. And the question is, can we use this information to better predict who is likely to have a ventricular tachycardia and sudden cardiac death? So there's been several groups now that have looked at what they've defined as gray zone, which is essentially what we believe is this infarct heterogeneity region, where they identify the infarct, they identify kind of signal intensities that are somewhere between the core infarct and the healthy tissue. So they've labeled the core infarct here red, the in-between zones yellow, and essentially tried to look at, is the relationship between the amount of this in-between signal intensity, this gray zone, which is believed to be this heterogeneous infarct, and various predictors of sudden cardiac death. And these are a couple of the studies in the literature. And more specifically, what they do is, it's a very simple math here. They essentially manually draw the endocardial and the epicardial border. And in one case, they'll draw an ROI in the remote zone and basically say anything that's more than 3 standard deviations above that, let's say, is, say, gray zone, and if it's more than 5 standard deviations above, it's infarct, something like that. And a little more sophisticated analysis would say also look for the peak signal intensity, and anything that's less than 50% of the peak is gray zone, and more than the peak of the remote zone is also gray zone. So very, very simple statistics. So if this works anything, then this must be real, because it's not terribly scientific how they're defining the gray zone right now. So in fact, in the very first study that identified the gray zone based on just number of standard deviations of signal above the remote territory, they were able to show that essentially patients with more gray zone did poor. Effectively, their survival was lower than those with less gray zone. And so that was the initial study, overall just showing that more people died if they had more gray zone. A second study in 2007 focused more on the question of ventricular tachycardia. And so when they put in these ICDs, they'll often try and pace the patient into ventricular tachycardia. And so this was a study to see if the amount of gray zone, the amount of this heterogeneous infarct as defined by MRI, was predictive of who was going to be inducible for ventricular tachycardia. So you see these two patient groups, those that weren't inducible versus those that were inducible. And it turns out that among the various potential predictors, end diastolic volumes, total amount of infarct, the one predictor that actually separated these groups was the amount of gray zone. Those who were inducible for ventricular tachycardia had more gray zone than those who were not. So it's, again, that's suggestive that maybe this MRI measure is indicative of this infarct heterogeneity, which will predict more likely who is going to suffer from ventricular tachycardia. And finally, this recent study out of the Netherlands 2 years ago specifically showed, again, that those patients with more gray zone were more likely to have ICD firings, that once they put in the implantable cardio defibrillator, that those patients with those defibrillators actually had more firings if they had more gray zone. So, i.e., they benefited from having that ICD, whereas those who had less gray zone did not necessarily benefit from having those ICDs, and could we convince ourselves that perhaps those patients didn't really need an ICD? So this is all suggestive that it makes sense to actually try and measure this characteristic, and perhaps it maybe is a better measure than ejection fraction for deciding who should get an ICD or not. But as I noted before, the math behind the measure of gray zone right now is very crude. Basically, if you have more noise in your image, then the standard deviation in the background is going to be higher, then that's going to alter your threshold for what you define as gray zone. Or if you choose a different remote region, for instance, if you're saying the gray zone is basically signal that's beyond the peak of the signal in the remote region, obviously it depends on the statistics how that's going to affect your estimate of your gray zone. So you can see that there's a lot of variability in the size of the gray zone just based on the changing your remote region or the amount of noise in your remote region based on, for the various techniques. And also, if you know, just drawing the endocardial border, that's all done manually right now. Depending on where you draw the endocardial border will also affect the amount of gray zone. So here, it's kind of hard to draw an endocardial border if you can't really see the difference between the blood pool very well and the infarct. So again, that could affect how much gray zone is determined. So more variability in this measure means less specificity in the ability to identify who's going to benefit from an ICD. So you'll see this afternoon, if you come to the cardiac segmentation workshop, there's efforts to improve the working from these types of images, improve the robustness and repeatability of the segmentation and the identification of gray zone by trying to more automatically identify the border between the epicardial and the endocardium, or better think of just better statistical measures that are more robust in defining this in-between signal intensity. We've locally also, however, taken the approach that you can also just improve the quality of the information going in. As was noted, the source of this, the characterization of this infarct is based on the faster recovery of signal in the infarct zone versus in the healthy zone. And why not actually sample the recovery curve and better measure this recovery function, which describes how much gadolinium is leaking into the space, which basically then describes how much fibrosis you have in these chronic infarcts. So with this kind of an imaging sequence, effectively in the same time it takes to make that single image, we can generate a series of images with different contrasts from which you can actually calculate the concentration, roughly speaking, of the gadolinium. And so now we have a series of images rather than a single image, and it turns out that we can manipulate the contrast so that we also get better contrast between the blood pool and the infarct, so it makes it easier to distinguish the border between those two. And this now gives us a much more rich basis of information from which to do the signal processing to calculate where how much gray zone we've got. So this is basically a data set where you can see that we're acquiring a bunch of different contrasts. Actually, over the cardiac cycle, what we try and do is get a series of contrasts while the heart is relatively stationary, so we can effectively do calculations on a bunch of images that are in the same cardiac phase. And so now we have this information to start with rather than just this information to start with to identify these infarct regions. And so effectively what we can do is more automatically take this basis information and try and identify the core infarct, the healthy tissue, the blood pool, and the gray zone. And specifically how we do that is we identify a series of images with different contrast that are relatively in the same cardiac phase. You could actually do some contouring and checking of this to make sure that these are all in roughly the same position. Then on a pixel by pixel basis, what we look at is the signal intensity recovery at each position, and we fit an exponential recovery curve, so which then gives us a term T1, which is kind of the speed of the recovery, which should be related to the amount of gadolinium, which should be related to the amount of fibrosis, as well as the steady state term, which actually gives us more information about the blood pool. And based on those two parameters, now we can make a parameter map of the steady state term and the T1 star term. So that and you can see just from the images that we're getting a good depiction of the infarct zone and being able to differentiate between the blood pool and the myocardium. If we then put that into a two-parameter space and apply some kind of a clustering, fuzzy clustering algorithms, here we use a Gustafson-Kessel method to identify three regions basically representing the blood pool, the healthy tissue, and the infarct, and then classify those regions, and then using fuzzy clustering, identify the gray zone as pixels that would have some probability in between being in the infarct zone and in the healthy tissue, basically somewhere between 25% and 75% being in one of those two categories, and we'll define that now as perhaps a more objective measure of infarct heterogeneity. And that gives us now a way of calculating gray zone that's a little bit more objective based on better raw data, I would say. And with that, we can show that this technique gives similar measures if you get good delineation of the infarct boundaries and the like, as the gray zone size is determined by the quote best technique out there right now, the signal intensity method, where you've defined a peak signal intensity and a remote signal intensity and define gray zone as somewhere in between there. But it actually has much less variability because there's much less sources of noise, much less sensitive to noise. Obviously, it doesn't have any manual contours, doesn't have a remote region you have to choose. So whereas the variability was fairly high in the estimates of gray zone with the previous technique, the variability should be a lot less with this technique because it's much more automated. And we see that in a small study of patients who are being considered for ICDs. The gray zone estimate with this technique predicts the difference between the group that is inducible versus the group that isn't inducible, whereas with a small patient population, while there is a trend for the previous technique to identify those that are inducible, it's not statistically significant with the small population here. So we're hopeful that by, one, starting with better data, and two, creating a more objective automated analysis technique, that you're going to get more repeatable measures which give more specific prediction of those who are potentially inducible for VD, and more importantly, those who will have ICD firings, those who will benefit from the ICD. This also just shows that likely the amount of gray zone should be related to how fast the reentry circuit kind of folds back on itself. More gray zone means kind of more slow conduction zone. That might be a slower cycle length. And we certainly see a relationship in a few patients where less gray zone has a faster cycle length, which actually could be more dangerous, whereas more gray zone in some cases has a faster cycle length. So there could be a threshold effect as well. So that's kind of step one, is if you could identify patients who would benefit from ICD therapy with a non-invasive method, such as imaging, looking at the structural heart disease, would certainly help to focus our limited healthcare resources on those who would most likely benefit. But again, ICDs are a band-aid. It would be really nice if we could help these patients and get rid of these arrhythmias altogether, and that's the goal of ablation therapies, but again, of limited use right now because they have limited success. So our second question is, could we actually use this information to better identify the substrates of the arrhythmias and help to guide the ablations? So as was noted right now, the way that they try and identify these reentry circuits is they take a catheter, they pass it into the ventricle, and essentially poke it around point by point. They have some spatial information about the location of the catheter. So at each point, they can sort of map out the electrical signal at each point. If they gate that to an electrocardiogram, then they can see the arrival of the action potential at the various points in space as it corresponds relatively to other points in space, and effectively make a map of the action potential propagation. And they can look for these slow conduction zones and these reentry circuits. But this mapping procedure is very slow. They basically are getting, you know, one point every maybe 20, 30 seconds. They typically want hundreds of points. So they could take hours to do this mapping procedure. And this is all done under X-ray guidance right now. When it works well, they'll identify a scar region, for instance, as regions of no conductivity. And then they'll have a sense of the action potential propagation if they then kind of artificially remap these arrival times. And then they can essentially play a video. Hopefully this one plays. Yeah, so you can see the activation wave passing, in this case, through an isthmus of slow conduction, looping around this infarct zone, and this is the reentry circuit. So if you could recognize that, you could ablate across this region, specifically here is that slow conducting isthmus, then you could get rid of this patient's arrhythmia and essentially get rid of their risk of sudden cardiac death. So this is the ideal situation. Again, it's hard to get these kind of images and hard to have confidence that you've identified the main source of the arrhythmia. So it's time-consuming. It also, you're only getting the electrical information on the endocardial surface. What happens if those reentry circuits are deeper? It's harder to get that information based on this probing of an electrode on the endocardial surface. So often you miss lesions. And to find these reentry circuits, you often have to pace the heart. You'll actually put the patient sometimes into VT, which, of course, is a hemodynamically unstable situation. So they've got to be shocked out of that. You don't really want to do that too often with a patient. So it's a less than ideal, quote, diagnostic strategy to find these arrhythmias. So what we want to do is see if we can actually help this electrophysiology exam by providing extra structural information, from the MRI, and in fact, relating the MRI to expected electrical propagation based on putting the MRI information into a model of electrical activity and essentially informing that model with limited electrical measurements, let's just say a few points of invasive mapping, or potentially even inform it with the kind of surface mapping that was described in the previous lecture. We know, again, that there does seem to be correspondence between these regions of slow conduction as identified under MRI and the reentry circuits based on animal models. This is work out of Hopkins, where they took animal models, they put them into ventricular tachycardia. They identified, this is an isochronal map, again, showing the different arrival time. They identified the region of slow conductivity, and it corresponded well to these regions of infarct and infarct border. So that suggests that this is promising to essentially inform the electrical measurements with structural measurements from the MRI. So what we are trying to do is we basically, in an animal model first, right now, the first thing that Sorry about that. Okay. So if we actually tune up the conductivity of the various regions of the heart based on some of the electrical information in those maps from a single pacing point, we can improve the simulation and get better correspondence between the measured value and the simulated value. So this, what we've done is divided the heart into about 20 segments and estimated the conductivity in each of those regions to regionally parameterize the model and get better propagation maps. And you could think of, instead of doing this with the fluorescence dye, you might probe a few spots with the electrical measurement or potentially use these surface measurements to better estimate what the conductivities are in these various regions. So now that was a healthy heart with propagation. But how do we do with an infarct heart? So now again, we take the MRI data set. Turns out the same technique that gives us the fibers, we can also use to identify the infarct. And we can segment the core infarct with the border zone. Here just showing that we get good correspondence between histology and the segmentation of the infarct and the infarct heterogeneous regions with based on these maps of apparent diffusion coefficient. And with that segmentation of the model, we say that those infarct regions have zero conductivity, the border zone may have slow conductivity, and then we just parameterize the rest of the heart based on a few measurements, and we get good characterization. Again, this is the isochronal map measured of the different arrival times of the action potential wave, and here it is after some adjustment with the simulation. And again, we get good correspondence between those two maps. So hopefully, again, with the structural information and a few electrical measurements, you can quickly zone in on where the reentry circuit is and potentially if it's accessible through ablation. The next step has been to take this in vivo, where we're doing the electrical measurements in vivo instead of doing the fluorescence imaging, similar to the way that they do it now in clinic, where they'll go and poke various points in the tissue with, say, a CARTO mapping system. Right now, this is, again, is an in-between step. We're still doing the parameterization of the model with MRI ex vivo, so we still estimate where the scars are with that level of information. This is just the animal model. We create an infarct with blocking off a coronary vessel, just as might happen in somebody's heart attack. Wait about 4 to 6 weeks, again, the time to kind of establish this fibrosis, and then do the electrical mapping in vivo and identify, say, via the voltage map, the regions of scar, and then also do the isochronal map of the timing of the arrival of the action potentials. And we can now compare this to our estimates based on the model. Again, right now we've done the ex vivo map. We've identified the regions of infarct. We've then done the mapping into the model and predicted the isochronal maps based on simulation here that we see the early arrival time under sinus rhythm here and then later arrival times further out. And here's the actual CARTO map with an early arrival time up here and later arrival times here. So we actually get pretty good correspondence. And this is just the simulated characterization of the depolarization and repolarization wave, which leads to the simulated isochronal maps. Again, this is actually a heart that was inducible into VT. Via the CARTO map, we can see a relatively small infarct, but it turns out that around that infarct, there was a reentry circuit that was identifiable based on pacing. You can see the rapid heart rate that gets created with ventricular tachycardia. Again, ex vivo, we were able to do the MR data sets, identify the fiber orientations, inform that all into the model, and essentially create different zones of different conductivity. And putting that into the model, able to predict where that reentry circuit is. So that's all very encouraging. So the next step is, could we get that information in vivo directly from MRI and guide the study? The creation of these fiber maps is very difficult because, as I say, the technique that gathers that data is very sensitive to motion. So another approach would be essentially use atlas information to get a first guess of where those fibers are and the fiber orientations across the heart, which is fairly consistent across individuals. We're now starting to get some databases of actually human hearts and the fiber orientations, some work that's going on in France. If we can then just essentially start with a good guess as to where those fibers are, and perhaps with limited measurements of attempt to characterize the fiber orientations, create a synthetic data set, can we get similar maps of arrival times? Turns out, at least in this animal model, with just a knowledge of where the infarct is, the zero conduction zones, and a guesstimate of the fiber orientations, we get a pretty good relationship between the estimated arrival times using the synthetic fibers versus the directly measured ex vivo orientation of the fibers with relatively small errors. So that's encouraging to say we don't have to get perfect estimation of all the fiber orientations if we get a good guess to start with. The second area is getting good maps of where the infarct is and the infarct heterogeneity. As I noted in our ex vivo studies, we were actually using a technique called diffusion tensor imaging. But in vivo, as per my earlier part, we can actually get estimates of where these infarcts are with these delayed contrast enhancement data sets. And this is a segmentation from an in vivo data set in the animal model and from the ex vivo data set based on DPI. And we get pretty good correspondence. These hearts are in slightly different phase. But you can see the infarct corresponds to relatively the same region of the heart. And the infarct heterogeneity also corresponds to relatively the same region. So that suggests that the MCLE, these in vivo methods of measuring infarct and infarct heterogeneity are similar to the ex vivo methods, and hopefully then we can use them to inform the computer models to help guide the electrophysiology exam. And then finally, can we do all of this inside an MRI system? And that's been an effort of a few groups. Some of the earliest work was done in Boston now almost 10 years ago, where they built up a whole system where they had the ability to monitor the electrophysiology, the ability to actually measure the electrophysiology in vivo, all compatible with the MR system. And now that's being commercialized by a couple of companies. And so we're hoping that that will get into patient studies within the next year or so. But with this technique, they were and MR-compatible catheters, they were able to do electrical mapping directly. So you can imagine grabbing an MR data set, identifying where the infarct is, using the MR data directly inside the MR to guide where to do your measures, get a few measures to help parameterize the characteristics of the electrical propagation, put that all into the model, do predictions as to where you should be sampling to more rapidly get to the area of the reentry circuit, and then guide the ablation and essentially tell the clinician where to do their ablation to get rid of the reentry circuit. So this is actually what we have working now up at Sunnybrook, where we can directly look at the catheter. We've got an MR-compatible catheter that we can track based on some active tracking points. We can basically know where the pacing catheter is, where the mapping catheter is, so we know where we're gathering electrical signal very accurately relative to the cardiac anatomy. This just shows that we can actually pace the heart inside the MR system and capture the pacing rhythm. We can also look at the sinus rhythm, just the regular electrical activity, by putting the electrode on the heart and looking at the signal arrival. So all the tools are in place for gathering this information now inside an MRI system and informing the sampling directly and guiding it with the MR data. And ultimately, the goal is then to identify the reentry circuit and go and place RF lesions, essentially burn the tissue, damage the tissue so that the tissue no longer conducts electrical signal. If you can then place the lesions across that isthmus and get rid of the conductivity, then you've solved the problem. And MR can also monitor that attempted solution, because you can actually see those lesions, those RF lesions, directly under MRI. Here's the lesions in the explanted heart that correspond to lesions in vivo that you can see various dots. So there's the potential to actually try and do the therapy, and then actually check it with MRI to make sure that you've actually created a region of non-conductivity, so that you know that you've gotten rid of the reentry circuit. So in summary, there's an opportunity for imaging to improve the planning, the interventional guidance, and the procedural assessment in ventricular arrhythmias, particularly as an early phase. We think we can use MR tissue characterization and modeling to identify those at risk. So as an early stage, better target the use of, say, ICDs for patients most likely to benefit. And then also to identify treatment targets, such as these reentry circuits, and potentially even directly guide these RF ablations under MRI to eliminate the arrhythmias, and then essentially hopefully produce a cure for these patients rather than just using the ICDs as a Band-Aid. So I'd like to thank all these various individuals who've contributed to this effort over the last few years and contributed slides and various funding sources, and thank you for your attention. Sure, yeah.